Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Today we're hearing from singer-songwriter and playwright Anais Mitchell. Anais Mitchell spent the past 16 years building the world of Hadestown, a career-defining stage musical. Hadestown is a Depression-era retelling of the Greek myth of Orpheus, Eurydice, Hades, and Persephone. It has grown from a low-budget community production in her native Vermont to a concept album to a Broadway phenomenon and the winner of 8 Tony Awards, including Best Musical and Best Original Score. But in March 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic shuttered theaters, Anais, like so many others, moved back home to Vermont. She was 9 months pregnant with her second child. The move and change of pace inspired her to start writing indie folk songs. Her self-titled album, released at the beginning of 2022, is made up of those songs. It's produced by Josh Kaufman and was made with collaborators like Bon Iver, The National, and her own band, Bonnie Light Horseman. The project is Anais' first collection of all new material under her own name in 10 years. On today's episode, Bruce Headlam speaks with Anais Mitchell about her new album, her experiences growing up in a small town, and how Hadestown came to be. She also plays some songs off her new album live for us. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Before we get into the conversation, here's Anais Mitchell's live performance of her song, Bright Star, off her new album.
Bright star, when I first laid eyes upon you, I was filled with such a longing to be with you in the dark. Bright star, since I could not fly beside you, I would chart my own course by you, and I'd sail it by your light. Bright star, I have sailed in all directions, I have followed your reflection to the farthest foreign shore. Bright star, bright star, I have anchored in the harbor, I have brought my gifts to barter for a drifter's bed and board. Bright star, I have drunk the wine of ages in the company of strangers. We have sung in tongues of angels and in stars. pavement, and I understood my place then, and my purpose in relation to the young and ancient night. Bright star, I'm home now from my roaming. I'm alone now in the gloaming, with the ships out in the yard. Bright star, there's a thought upon me dawning. You have launched a thousand longings, and I don't know who you are. Bright star, you have never been my vessel, or the wind my sails have wrestled, or the lands to which I traveled, or the friends with whom I reveled. There are lengths to which you'll never know I went to be your lover and beloved in your sight. Bright star, when I first laid eyes upon you, I was filled with such a longing to be with you in the dark. Bright star, if I could have flown beside you, I would not have had the sight of you to guide me through the world so wide and bright.
So, your self-titled album. Why are self-titled albums always late in people's careers now? I don't know. Tell me about making this album.
Right. It's funny to make a self-titled record at this stage. Mm-hmm. But for me, it felt really appropriate. Like, I started out as a singer-songwriter, and I, you know, made a bunch of records when I was sort of in my 20s. And then I started working on this musical, Hadestown, in my mid-20s, and it just sort of took over my creative world. And so it had been a long time since I had actually been able to sit down with my guitar and write kind of what wanted to passed through my heart, regardless of, you know, plot and character development and all that stuff. And so it felt like a return in a way. And also, the songs on this record are all actually my own. I'm the speaker in all the songs is me, and the stories are my stories, which I kind of had never let myself do. Like, I always wanted to take on the voices of other characters and kind of tell other stories. It's a confessional, you know, confessional record. And so it felt right to put my name on it.
You know, that's funny because I would have assumed that your early things were confessional too. And maybe that's just the unfair cliche about women songwriters, that they're always just, you know, men are creating characters, women are just pouring out their hearts. Mm. But your early songs weren't like that, that you were taking on characters?
I mean, there was a few heart-pourer songs. Mm-hmm. But from early on, I really was kind of interested in dressing that stuff up in different ways. Well, you know, my very first record was like quite political, actually. It was influenced by like protest music and early Bob Dylan and stuff like that. And I made a record later called Young Man in America, which was, really taking on a lot of the voices of other characters. And a lot of me was in there. A lot of my feelings were in there, but I didn't have to stand there and sing it as if it was my own story. And I think I was maybe a little nervous to do a confessional sounding thing. I was afraid to be navel-gazy,
right,
in a way that I maybe perceived in like the 1990s, like coffee house world. I wanted to do something different than that.
What is it like now to get up on stage and confess your inner thoughts to an audience?
Well, everything is different now. You know, I think so many of us are just trying to figure out who we are and what is this what we do post-pandemic, and also for me post-Hadestown, because that became my identity for so long. And so to actually get up and play my own songs, and it feels familiar and also totally different. But I love what can happen with just kind of vulnerability of connecting with an audience. There's something about opening your mouth really wide to sing that feels vulnerable in its own right, but then to also be trying to just kind of be as hard on sleeve as possible. That felt like the project for this batch of songs.
Are there times you have trouble doing that on stage?
There's times when it doesn't feel real. Like, if it doesn't feel authentic, then it especially feels like a problem because the songs are so from the heart. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. If I'm playing a Hadestown song and I'm not 100% feeling it, that's okay. But if it's, you know, a heart poem and I'm sort of out to lunch, that doesn't feel right. But I wouldn't say that it's scary in terms of like to share the feelings. I love to do that.
When I sat down to listen to the record, the first song is Brooklyn Bridge. And I think, oh, this is going to be, because you were out of New York for the pandemic. I thought, oh, this is just going to be a New York record. I'm missing it. It's not. But the first song is this very romantic song about being in New York. Did you miss it?
Yeah, I totally missed it. So, right, the backstory is I was right about to have our second baby in March of 2020 and made a really like 11th hour decision to just pack a car and drive to Vermont, which is where I was born and raised. And that sort of time of stillness up there, I wrote a bunch of songs. And Brooklyn Bridge is actually one that I had tried to write when I was living in New York. I had the idea, and I almost, like, I wouldn't let myself write it. It felt, like, overly romantic. Mm-hmm. And even, like, the word Brooklyn, I didn't want to use. And then finally, when I left the city, I just kind of let myself feel the feelings of romance that I always have felt about this town. I was commuting to Manhattan a lot from Brooklyn when I was working on Hadestown, and there were some really special rides that I had with Rachel Chavkin, the director of the show, sometimes like after a really long day and a long night of like tech and rehearsal and then a meeting at the bar about the show, and then we'd be in a cab on riding over the bridge back to Brooklyn and kind of all of our hopes and dreams for the show, and some of that is in that song.
So tell me now about Bright Star.
So I had landed in Vermont, had the baby 1 week after we got there. And then literally I could see the stars again. I moved back to this family land, which is a sheep farm that my parents bought in like the 70s. And my parents have a house there. My brother's family has a house. And when my grandparents were alive, they had a little house on this same land. And that's where we moved to. And the stars are just thick up there. And so I was seeing that, and also I think, you know, we were all in that just strange time of stillness after so much activity, and it was really the first time I'd stayed in one place for as long as I could remember. The gaining of like a little bit of perspective on all of that restless pursuit of whatever it is, you know, whatever it is you're chasing, and kind of a feeling of making peace with it, that to me is what that song's about.
Was it strange living with your parents again or living around your parents and your family?
It was amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it was amazing, especially having a little newborn, right? Mm-hmm. To just be in the family kind of fold. And because everyone was locked down and quarantined at that time, and we had a whole farm full of people, you know, one person could go shopping for us all. And we'd have like dinners together. And, you know, I mean, the other side of the story is that we've ended up staying in Vermont, like we haven't moved back to New York. And then, you know, it became, okay, I'm going to be in proximity with my parents, my brother, my old friends, my like ninth grade English teachers I'm going to run into on the street in this small town where I grew up. And that had, you know, all kinds of feelings that came with that. Like I was a little scared to confront that stuff. But it's been pretty special and like healing in a way to like reestablish myself in that community. Yeah. Like, oh, here I am now at this point in my life.
Well, because you've got great songs about growing up there, but almost from this adult perspective, Backroads and Little Big Girl.
Yeah, there was a lot on this record that was inspired by returning to my home place and having a lot of memories about growing up there and also seeing it with the new eyes. I think that's the thing. Especially like it's a super small town, but I didn't know that growing up, you know.
How big is it?
That's a question I never know how to answer. Like populations, demographics, I don't know. But the town I went to high school in, essentially there's one main street. There's a pizza shop. There's like a coffee shop. There's a bar. And that's pretty much it.
What was growing up there like? What was it like in your home? Was there a lot of music in your house?
So my parents are not musicians, but my dad can carry a tune. My mom can't. And my dad was and is a writer. He wrote novels when he was young and then more kind of nonfiction stuff when he was older and he became an English professor at Middlebury College, which is right near where I grew up. And he also loves music and had a great record collection, and it lived kind of in the library with the books, and he loves lyrics. He would sing along to stuff and he would know every word. And this is kind of a special thing for me to witness as a kid. So certainly, like, I grew up in a house with a love of words, and I wanted to be a writer of some kind. And then it turned out like my way was to write songs.
What was his record collection?
Folk revival stuff. So it was Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell, and then some kind of psychedelic rock, like the Grateful Dead records and the, what are they called? Velvet Underground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to forget that.
Yeah, no.
In New York.
Especially in New York.
They're not going to let you back in New York if you
That's
don't.
That's right.
Sorry, you're going to have to leave.
Yeah. I mean, it's all, if you think about it, it's all very lyrically interesting stuff that he was into. My parents were like hippies. They grew up in the suburbs and they bought this farm as part of the kind of back to the land movement. And that's where they went, was to Vermont. And I was raised with my older brother there on this farm, and no television. My mom was anti-television. So there was a lot of just wild running half naked in the woods and making up games and stuff like that.
They were pro-sheep, anti-television.
Yeah, you got it.
When did the guitar start?
Yeah, my first instrument was a violin that I studied from age 7. I loved it, and also I hated it, and I didn't want to practice it and things like that. When I finally let go of that, I picked up the guitar, and I took like a few lessons, but very casually, from a guy who would essentially just teach me to play the songs I wanted to learn, which was a great motivator for actually learning how to play the guitar. And I guess I was maybe 15 or 16.
What were those songs?
Ani DiFranco was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mary Chapin Carpenter. I mean, I was into a lot of female songwriters that were kind of blossoming in that era. Dar Williams was one. Tori Amos, although that was sort of piano-based, so yeah. I didn't really learn those, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have a very particular guitar playing style. You Travis pick, but it's not the kind of usual rolling Travis pick. Where did you, how did you get that?
I don't use a pick. I really only play with my fingers, and yeah, it's bizarre. The guy that I learned from, Justin Perdue is his name, was like a jazzer. And he played with his fingers and he was double jointed in his hands. And he could play these beautiful, you know, finger style stuff. And I later, I learned kind of certain finger picking patterns when I was kind of in my early 20s, like just getting going. And then I feel like you just kind of, you learn a few and then you just are off to the races with them. And that's kind of been where I came from. We were saying before the interview that I recently started playing in open tuning, which I never did before. And it's so amazing because you honestly like could play with just one hand. Mm-hmm. Like you smoke a cigarette with the other hand.
Which you sometimes do. You're the only person I know who takes her hand off the fretboard sometimes.
Yeah, it's liberating.
Yeah, you see that with pianists, they'll lift one hand off. But I've never seen somebody just let the guitar go for... Did going to open tuning, did that change the way you wrote?
So I started to play open tuning in the context of this folk rock band I'm in called Bonnie Light Horseman, which was really like in when I was in the kind of most intense part of rewriting Hades Town, because I worked on that show for on and off for 13 years. And then as we were sort of, it became clear that we were heading for Broadway, it became my, you know, it was my sole focus. And no regrets, Coyote. Like I loved working on it, but I also was like completely overwhelmed by the stress of it. And I found that Bonnie Light Horseman was kind of like the one other creative thing I could do at the same time as working on this show. And it ended up being the kind of antidote or like medicine for me that I needed, which was early on, our first record is all kind of reworkings of traditional text. And so there was something really nice about like being able to draw from that well and like rest in that music rather than the act of writing Hades Town is very text focused and having to come up with a lot of stuff. And so there was that. And then also just from the get-go, we played open D tuning and it's just so wide open. It feels so epic and like expansive and spacious. Like you just want to let the chord ring out, put your hand in the air. So that became the kind of the antidote to Hades Town for me. And then I remember like at times I'd finish playing with Bonnie Light and I'd have to tune back up to standard tuning and I'd feel like I was putting on a corset to go back to standard. Standard is also great at this point. I'm ready to go back, but it's been a revelation to play open.
You know, you use a lot of color tones in your melodies. You use a lot of ninths. You're not just sticking to chord tones. And I was kind of wondering whether the open tuning sort of facilitated that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's that kind of, I associate it with like British Isles folk music. And the kind of ornamentation that you hear with like Irish singers, the way that their grace notes and the way they bend things. And I just find it really infinitely fascinating how you can just have one drone chord almost, and then the just infinite number of notes you could sing over it, and they'd be compelling in different ways. It's sort of like very simple and also sophisticated. I feel that about Irish music.
We'll be right back with more from Bruce Headlam and Anais Mitchell after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
We're back with more of Bruce's conversation with Anais Mitchell.
So you mentioned Hadestown, and we do have to talk about it.
Great.
You're like, yeah, I only worked on it for 14 years. Where did the idea come from?
It kind of came out of nowhere, but it was right. I was driving in my car kind of early on in my career as a singer-songwriter, driving like a super long distance between two gigs for like tips. And I I got this just melody kind of dropped into my lap, which was the chorus of that song, Wait For Me, from the show. And there was lyrics that came with it. It went, wait for me, I'm coming in my garters and pearls. With what melody did you barter me from the wicked underworld? And that was the lyrics that came with it.
That just came to you in a car?
It came in the car, yeah.
Now, did you pull over and write it down, or you had it?
I don't know what I would have done. That might have been pre-iPhone. I don't think I could have recorded it on my phone. But there was something about it that the language, obviously none of those lines ended up in the show, except for the first one. But the underworld and the kind of, it felt like the Eurydice and Orpheus story. And I thought, I think I was hungry to work on a long form thing, just like to see what could happen. I've always been into storytelling as a songwriter. I love like the ballads, the British Isles, like really long ballads. And I like the Texas, like raconteur, you know, Texas songwriter thing.
Yeah. It's
very like short story within a song. And just the idea of writing a bunch of songs that had to lean on each other and that you had to hear them all in order to get the full story. I also was like, I was right out of college. And I think, you know, I was a kind of young and idealistic and naive and creative coming into a world where, you know, just coming up against the way the world is, you know, politically at that time. And also, and now you have to pay the rent and things like that. And there was something about that coming of age or that story that felt inherent to the Orpheus myth. You know, he's this optimistic character who believes he can do an impossible thing. And then he comes up against, you know, the way the world is. And so there is a way in which like that story was a catch-all for like a lot of things that I was going through at that time.
Did you see a film? Like, did you see Black Orpheus or something? What made you think of the Orpheus?
Yeah,
myth?
I always had known that myth. I remember I read it in a children's illustrated book of mythology, the Dolores book.
My son has them all.
Yes, I got them for my kids too. yeah, there's an illustration. And the story is just so beautiful and strange that it doesn't have a happy ending. You expect it. It's all set up for a Hollywood ending. You don't get it. And the hero is a musician, an artist. And then I did, because I was curious, I watched Black Orpheus, and there's a Cocteau film, L'Orfeu. Mm-hmm. There's the Tennessee Williams play.
That's right.
Orpheus,
yeah.
Descending.
And there's a French version that I think was translated. Maybe Richard Burton was in it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
A lot of people have been inspired by it, you know. Oh, Sarah Rule. There's an amazing play by Sarah Rule called Eurydice, I think. It's a myth that's just contains so much raw, like, potential energy in it that it kept the wind in our sails, you know, mine and everyone else who worked on it for so long. And it always felt like as much effort as we all were putting in, elbow grease, like creatively, it also was as if we were unearthing a thing that already existed. Like I thought a lot of times about that idea of the sculpture in the stone, you know, that the sculpture's already there.
Yeah.
And you just, it would chipping away at it. And then occasionally you'd be like, oh, that, you know, this, that orchestration choice, that choreography thing, that costume piece, like, this set piece, that's the sculpture in the stone. Like you sort of would feel it. I think we all would probably feel the same way about it, that it revealed itself to us.
Now, at that point, you were a young songwriter. And I imagine had you said to your record label or anybody else, yeah, I want to do a musical about Orpheus, a lot of people would say, just put out another album, just tour. Was it hard to say to people, this is what I want?
To their credit, I was working with Righteous Babe Records at the time, Ani DeFranco's record label, who put out my kind of second singer-songwriter record. And then I started working on this piece. And before we made that record, it began in Vermont, where I was living, as this like DIY community theater project. My friend Michael Chorney, who's like the original orchestrator of the piece and who continued all the way to Broadway, was arranging the songs for his like little band that he had at the time. And there was an early director, Ben Matchstick, and we put up this kind of ragtag version of the thing. It was, you know, not, there's half as many songs or maybe a quarter as compared to what's on stage now. But there was something about it that felt really vibey. And I remember the label sent a couple people and they saw it. And they said, like, yes, we'd love to support this. And Ani said she would sing the role of Persephone before anyone else was on board. So it was really, they were actually very supportive. And then it became this record with these other sort of more famous guest singers. And those guys are an important part of the story because I don't know that it would have caught the ear of as many folks as it did if they hadn't been involved. And then I did a lot of touring around with it as just a concert piece. And finally, like, moved to New York City, decided I wanted to develop it further, met the producers and Rachel, and that was almost like the halfway mark, and then 6 or 7 more years of development.
Did your enthusiasm ever flag for it? It's such a long process.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever think, am I crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought, would I ever make another record of my own songs, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'd say, like, the toughest thing was the amount of kind of banging my head against a wall in a small writing space in Gowanus where I was living, trying to rewrite the stuff again and again. But when I was in the room with my collaborators and, you know, with the actors who are able to just pull rabbits out of hats all the time and, you know, make you see the work in a different way, that always was like really inspiring. And there is that thing of like a musical is a really collaborative form, and you got to show up for people. You got to show up for the people you're working with and vice versa. And I was inspired by the folks I was working with. I wanted to show up for them.
What's terrifying though is if this thing bombs, and I don't want to give away the ending, but it doesn't bomb, you know, people are out of work. And did you feel that kind of weight?
No, I don't think so. I just was fixated on, I wanted it to be as good as it could be when it got to Broadway. And the fact we got off Broadway was a miracle in its own right, you know, and then to have landed on Broadway at all was a miracle.
Because you toured with it after off Broadway, right? You went to Edmonton.
Yeah, we did development
England, in
Edmonton, and then we went to London to the National Theater there.
Yeah. At this point, were you saying, God, how long does it take to develop a musical?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I needed all that time. I mean, I think we needed it. Because I am not trained in this world, in this form. And so there was just a big learning curve. Like, I know how to write a songwriter song that's 3.5 minutes long, and it's got 3 verses and a chorus, maybe a bridge. And that's part of writing for the stage. But there's, you know, this whole other element of drama and how to make a satisfying drama and songs needing to have results at the end of them or, you know, revelations.
It's got to move the plot along.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or it's got to build character. Do you remember there were things that your director here told you? Like, did she say, you got to go home and write a song about X because that's missing from this show?
Yeah, for sure.
What was that like?
Well, Rachel is a very inspiring and kind of hardcore person. She's kind of tough love, which I needed, you know? Mm-hmm. When I first started working with her, I remember like the very first table read that we did. She kind of followed up afterwards with this like laundry list of things that she thought could be improved. And I was like, you got to understand, I've been working on this already for, you know, 6 years. And she was like, well, if we're going to work together, you'll have to find a way to move past your fatigue. And I was like, wow, you know, this lady's serious. And I needed that. And it wasn't just her. We worked with an amazing dramaturg named Ken Chernelia. And also our producers, especially Mara Isaacs, were very involved kind of dramaturgically, like, you know, meeting on a regular basis about stuff. I loved it in a way. It's nice to have people to show up for, and it's nice to have a kind of accountability. And my work for like the development of the Broadway show coincided with me having my first kid. Mm-hmm. And there was something about the discipline of like, all right, there's going to be a reading in this many weeks. And so I had to carve out this time. That felt like very grounding for me, becoming a new mom and, you know, your whole schedule is upended. I wasn't able to go about things the way I would in my songwriter world where I'm like, well, when inspiration strikes, I'll work on this.
I mean, we can give away the ending. It won the Tony for Best Musical. You won for Best Original Score. You also wrote the book, though. You didn't, I'm sure people along the way said, well, you're a musician, but you can't write a book for a Broadway musical. Did you always say, nope, I'm doing it?
You know, it's a funny thing. I always have been very moved by musicals that are like sung through.
Right.
Les Mis is one of my favorites, probably my favorite of all time. And I love Hamilton. I love Sweeney Todd. You know, I love a lot of these shows where there's not that moment of like the book scene that then becomes a song through mm-hmm. that awkward transition.
Yeah.
And just the suspension of reality.
It's closer to opera that has recitative.
Exactly. There. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, early on there was talk of like, should we bring in a book writer for this? And I felt nervous about what that would do to the piece, which really had its roots in the music world and wanted to kind of remain sort of straddling the like world of concert and the world of drama. Eventually, they, you know, people stopped suggesting that we get a book writer.
After a few stares from you.
Yeah, yeah. It took a lot of kind of learning to figure out, like, how to write that sort of recitative stuff. And the first thing we did was we created Hermes, who's able to just speak to the audience and literally tell them what's going on, you know, a narrator figure. And then, and so it felt easier to kind of write in that way. And then eventually I was like, Rachel, I think I need Orpheus and Eurydice to speak to each other. And she said, yeah, I think you should do that. And I was like, but it's got to rhyme and it's got to be, you know, metered. Yeah. And she's like, okay. And so that's, you know, that's what recitative is. And it's, yeah, it's very hard to write.
I'll bet. Now, had you read a lot of poetry? Is there something that sort of guided you with that? Or did you just sit down and figure it out?
Yeah, I just sat down and figured it out. I mean, I guess inspired by the musicals that use that. I mean, Les Mis is a great example. That's mm-hmm. so incredible, the way that those motifs kind of come back around right. in the recit stuff. And yeah, I mean, I think the tricky thing about it is that it's like, it's both a totally rarefied conversation going on, and also it has to kind of sound natural, mm-hmm. you know, because it is, after all, like a scene between two people.
Yeah. The other thing you do in this musical is you create a world, which I often think, you know, when you see Broadway shows, you say, well, they're trying to convince me of this world. I'm not quite buying it. But you create this whole underground that's America of long ago, but not really. I'm not even sure where it is chronologically. Mm-hmm. It's affected by climate change, but it feels like 20s depression.
Yeah.
How did you conceive of that? How did you make that work?
You're right. It's meant to not be set in a particular time or place. It's really, you know, this mythic space. But it takes a lot of inspiration from the Depression era because of the themes, I think, there was in that era, like the Dust Bowl, right? And the kind of the dust storms that were created by this like industrial, agricultural overreach, really like a man-made natural disaster, just like what we see now with climate change, but on a smaller scale and sort of a more poetic and vintage scale. And also a lot of the music that I was inspired by, the kind of like protest stuff, the IWW, like labor organizing songs, Woody Guthrie, stuff like that, that I always found very inspiring. And those themes were very present in that era in terms of the sort of exploitation of labor and then the unionization of labor. And those are also themes that show up in our show. And yeah, you know, it was funny that I remember a really important moment in the writing for Off-Broadway, where I figured out that Hermes could just say, don't ask where, brother, don't ask when. It was a road to hell. It was hard times. It was a world of gods and men. That he could actually tell the audience not to worry about what what year it was or what the mm-hmm. precise geographical location was. And then as an audience member, you're like, okay, I'm not going to worry about that, you know?
Do you remember coming up with that line?
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember the kind of light bulb moment was seeing it come out of the mouth of the character at the top of the show. And the character who was playing Hermes at that time, Chris Sullivan. And actually, you know, the dramaturg I was mentioning, Ken Chernelia, he sort of came from a different world than us. He was working for Disney at the time. And he was very into this, like, just take care of the audience at the top of the show, you know? Just establish, mm-hmm. like, where we are. So they're not spending the whole first act trying to figure it out. Something about letting people know they didn't have to worry about that, that mm-hmm. felt like it did an important thing.
It makes them open to
right.
the experience. And then a lot of the orchestration, it feels very like New Orleans.
Yeah.
Influenced.
Yeah, that's because right.
The Dust Bowl thing makes me think you could have done sort of very sparse Western country, but it's mm-hmm. got a different kind of feeling to it. And
yeah.
a little bit of Hadestown feels a little bit like, it's got a little bit of French Quarter to it.
Definitely.
There's a bar,
yeah,
a lot of drinking.
And yeah. our path, I think, was quite different from other musicals in that, like I mentioned, Michael Chorney, who was arranging the songs way back at the beginning, you know, in this DIY version of the show. And when we made our studio record, Todd Sickafoos produced this album. He's the bassist for Ani DeFranco. So it was all kind of in the family. And he produced it and then began to also add arrangements at that time, and then became a co-arranger with Michael. And the orchestrations have been baked into the story, you know, since the beginning. Where I think a lot of shows, the theater's like obsessed with text, and they just, you know, they don't, music's like, is music happening? Okay, great. Mm-hmm. they're so focused on what's happening in the text. And this show, like, necessarily, it couldn't be that way because it was just sort of turned upside down. Like, it had come from this really musical place. And those guys are both, you know, jazz influenced, and Michael and Todd, and also kind of art rock, indie rock influenced. And yeah. There was also something about the New Orleans sound that felt right. Like New Orleans feels like a mythic city, right? And it being kind of right on the front lines of a lot of this stuff, the kind of poverty and the climate stuff, it felt like the right place.
You started writing this before the financial meltdown.
Yeah.
Did that influence you at all in the kind of like the sudden people out of their homes and this sudden upheaval
yeah.
in the country?
You know, it's been so wild with this show because at different moments, what was happening in current events seemed to be speaking directly, you know, through the mm-hmm. songs in a way that the songs hadn't been intended that way. But I remember that song, Wedding Song, mm-hmm. you know, times being what they are, hard and getting harder all the time. I used to play that in my songwriter shows, and I would introduce the song by saying, like, this is from this folk opera I'm working on. It's set in a post-apocalyptic American Depression era. Mm-hmm. And people started to laugh, like, really hard when I would say that. And I was like, what's going on? You know, and it was that yeah. they were feeling the connection between the financial breakdown and that song. And then later, obviously, that song, Why We Build the Wall,
right.
which was written also in like 2006, started to resonate really hard with the stuff that our former president was saying in his campaign.
Right. And the lyric is,
yeah, why do we build the wall? My children, you know, we build the wall to keep us free. The enemy is poverty, and we mm-hmm. build the wall. The wall keeps out the enemy, and we build the wall to keep us free. And that's another one that I played in my songwriter shows for years, and I never expected it to feel new again. And then it did.
Okay. Now, I'm sure a million people have asked you, but I have to ask you anyway. You've been working on this for 13 years, and it must have seemed like a pipe dream at many points. You see it on stage, which I'm sure you get rapturous reviews. First of all, what was that like? You see it in old movies like Betty Davis waiting to see what the morning paper says about a performance. What is it like to actually sit around and wait for a review from the newspaper?
Right. Oh, it's so funny in the theater because the reviews come out like right after the show
yeah.
and everyone's at a party. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're like having some champagne at like a party, and then someone will like pull out their phone in the women's room and there's the New York Times review. Yeah, I was a deer in the headlights. I mean, when I think about it, I was so kind of exhausted from the effort of the rewriting. And I remember just like, yeah, on, I think it was opening night, I got to go up, you know, with Rachel with the cast and sort of take a bow, and someone handed me a big bouquet of flowers. I didn't know. I didn't know what to do with it, so I just put it on the ground.
Well, you really are new to the theater. You didn't know they gave you flowers?
Yeah, it was very awkward for me. And but mostly just because I was completely overwhelmed by the experience. I didn't have a way to process it in the moment or feel proud or relieved or any of those things, you know. It was actually pretty powerful to, after the long shutdown, we shut down for a year and a half, and then we reopened. We had a reopening night where I'm like well rested, well hydrated, and got to really enjoy that, you know, experience of seeing the show again and also seeing the like coming back to life of the theater and of New York City and the culture, you know, in general. That felt really powerful. But the main thing I think I'll say about that time was like, yeah, I remember one time I was staying in Manhattan. So I was working on the show as much as I could. I didn't want to commute back and forth to my apartment in Brooklyn. Couldn't sleep. I was up early and I went for a jog around Midtown in the dark. And I jogged past the theater and there was like these kids who were camped out outside the theater waiting to get tickets. I don't know, rush tickets or what. I'm not sure what the situation was. But and some of them were dressed up cosplaying, you know, our characters. And that was a moment where I was like, I have no idea what this show is. Like, I don't know what it means to, I'm never going to know what the relationship is of these kids to this show. It's not mine, you know, it's its own animal. And it's like living in the world now, doing its thing. Powerful and strange feeling.
And then on Tony night, now you didn't win a lot of Off-Broadway awards.
That's right.
You played on Off-Broadway. Yeah. So did you go into the Tony saying, I got nominated, that's fine. Or did you think, maybe.
I don't remember. I remember I did have to sort of prepare some remarks just in case.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the awkward thing about the awards thing, since you have to get like all nervous and prepared, even if then nothing happens. Yeah, it was an extraordinary night. It was so amazing to see so many people on our team win Tonys. Mm. Andre, you know, Andre DeShields gave that incredible speech, and Rachel, and yeah, it was an amazing night.
You won 8 overall.
Yeah.
Including Best Musical.
David Byrne gave me my Tony. It was very special. And then I walked with him to the press room. Like,
you didn't put it on the ground like the flowers,
no,
did you? You
hung on managed, to that one? Yeah, yeah, right.
Now, is there going to be a movie?
I would love that. I'm not in a rush for that to happen, but I'd love that to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have to be animated, wouldn't it?
Oh, it's so interesting that you say that. Because I've thought that a bunch of times.
Yeah.
It's tricky to know. I'm really in a space of like, there was a lot of kind of talk of it right after Broadway. And it felt to me like, A, I got to take a break from this thing. I can't even look at it anymore. And B, like I really wanted a film adaptation to be its own animal and not feel like it was imitating what was happening on stage. And it's tricky because it's not, as you were saying, not set in a particular time or place. It's easy for it to be done kind of wrong if it's live action, I guess.
We'll be right back with more from Bruce Hedlum and Anais Mitchell after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music.
Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Let's hear a live performance of Anais Mitchell's song, Revenant, off her latest album.
Come on back again. Come on, Revenant.
come and take my hand, Evanescence. Come on back again, come on, Revenant. Come and take my hand, Evanescence. Come on back.
So you sit down to do this album, and then do those lessons from writing, characterization, moving it along, do they change your writing for this album?
Yeah, I know that I'm a different writer after Hadestown, but I can't really put my finger on what that is. Mm-hmm. Partly I felt so free. I felt so free to write whatever passed through my heart and to be just me and the instrument and the words, and that felt really freeing. But yeah, there's something that I did in that pandemic time that I never had done, never had allowed myself to do, although people had mentioned it many times, which is this idea of just writing a song a day for like a week. And I did it with a group of other songwriters, and it was this beautiful and intense experience where if you fail to write a song on a given day, then you're like lovingly excommunicated from the group.
Wow.
You don't finish the week. And so again, like a kind of a mutual accountability thing. And I found it so healing to have to say yes to whatever was wanted to come through and not second guess it. And a lot of the songs on this new record, actually that song Real World, I just wrote that in like an hour on one of those days. And a bunch of the other ones, I sort of began in that time and then finished them on my own time. Mm-hmm. So that was a sort of, I guess it was a kind of a discipline, but it also felt like just all bets are off and you're safe to fail, you know, and that felt really good.
Mm-hmm. But you couldn't not do it.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you need that kind of pressure, a Broadway show, angry songwriters.
Like replacing the critics.
Yeah.
The angry songwriters. Well, you know, I felt very free. I felt also like no one was watching and no one cared, which was important. I wrote the songs like more for me than anyone else and then suddenly realized like, oh, I'm going to make a record out of these. And then I was like, I got to do this record immediately. I don't want to sit on them and think about them and try to improve them.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Revenant.
That's a song I started in the Song a Day week. And it was really inspired by my grandparents' house that I was living in. There was a box full of my old journals and letter correspondences, and I reread a bunch of them. I burned some of my old journals, and some of them I kept, and there was a lock of hair, and I had this just real, like, visceral memory of being a kid in that house. You know, I grew up in my home, but I would run down the driveway to my grandparents' house, and it was kind of like my happy place. I could do crafting. My grandma was a quilter, and she always would have something on the stove. And I felt, yeah, in this way that you're kind of, when you're a little kid, you just become a part of your surroundings. And you get upset about something in the house, and you sort of run outside into the garden, and then you're just like one with the garden. That was the feeling that I think I was having in that house. And that word revenant is so beautiful because, you know, it's sort of a phantom, but also I think it literally means like one who comes back, like one who returns. And I'm not sure if that's me, you know, returning to that place of my childhood or my grandma, thinking about my grandma, but it felt like I was encountering her in some way. And encountering myself, I think, is the thing at the age that I am now. Looking in the mirror, you know, on her old bureau that I remember from being a kid, there's this old mirror, and it's kind of, you know, when a mirror goes kind of dark, and see my face now, and I'm the age I am now. You're as young as you'll ever be.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about the song Little Big Girl, which is a little political in points, but just tell me what inspired that.
So that's a song that took me years to write. I started that song in 2016, and I remember because I was on a tour with Patty Griffin and Sarah Watkins, and the first verse of it kind of just dropped into my lap, and I thought, oh, this is going to be easy. This is going to be an easy one to write. And I tried and tried it various times, and I just couldn't figure out how to finish it. And I was also working on Hadestown, and it was hard to put, you know, the time in. But I think also I had to live some more years, you know, have another kid, be a little older, return home. It's a song about growing older as a woman. And it's a little bit about my mom and a little bit about me and for my girls. And I think what made it hard to write actually is that there was times it was veering towards becoming sort of like a soapboxy thing, like me on a soapbox, having it all figured out, telling you what's wrong with the culture or whatever. And the truth is that, like, it's a song about not having it figured out. Like, it's a song about arriving at this age, thinking by now you'd have it figured out, and you don't. Mm. And essentially, like, yeah, the kind of, like, the tools that you gather as a young woman, the tools that work for you at a certain point no longer work for you. And the sense of, like, no one gave me the tools for now. Or, like, how do I acquire this new set of tools?
So is it a song? Is there a little bit of anger in the song that nobody gave you those tools?
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it's anger directed anywhere but at myself.
I mean, there's a really great line, and it's said in it's sexual context, but it has sort of this sort of wider meaning about let him have his way instead of saying what you want.
Right, yeah. I remember in the studio I was debating let them have their way versus let him have his way. You know, like, let them have their way felt less pointed, I guess, in terms of, like, gender stereotypes and whatever. And ultimately, the other thing felt more true. Like, it just felt more raw. But I think, yeah, you know, as a woman still, like, you learn to be sort of deferential and not to take up space. And so it's hard to learn how to do those things, you know.
You wrote a massively successful Broadway musical. There must have been points in which you had to stand up for yourself.
Yeah,
was that hard to learn?
I do stand up for myself, but I have a lot of feelings about it. You know, it takes a long time. Sometimes I have to, like, give in to another person's idea and then realize I'm miserable and then weeks later come back and say, actually, I need to do this way. Yeah, I wish there was less drama internally about that stuff. But it was actually really cool working with Rachel Chavkin, who's a total boss, and yeah, very, very assertive, and watching the way that she worked with people. I can remember, like, a time we were proofreading, like, the program for our show in London. And I wrote an email of something like, I don't know, what do you think about this? Maybe this could be a little bit more like this, you know, really deferential. And Rachel comes in and is like, what Anais is saying is she wants this. And, you know, it's powerful. She's good at that.
So it's a little easier now for you to say that?
I guess so. I guess it's a lifelong practice.
I do want to ask you a little bit about singing older songs. You did a whole really great album of child ballads, and child refers to the guy who collected the ballads, not actually children. You did your own version of Shenandoah. You did Hobo's Lullaby, which is the...
Yeah, wow, you did your research.
It's all up here. And a lot of it seems to relate to Hadestown in that when you do those songs, it almost kind of feels like the song's going through you. I don't know if that makes any sense. You know, that kind of experience of doing really old songs, making it your own, but it's like you're passing a baton or something. I guess what's the attraction for you to do those songs?
Uh-huh. It's so inspiring. I love traditional music, traditional text, and mythology and old stories. And for me, like, what I'm interested in always is the kind of, like, to be at the center of the Venn diagram of, like, what feels true and real for me and emotional and sort of heartful and tearful and alive. And then what feels like it's epic, mythic, universal. The center of that is where I always kind of want to be, because I guess it's like a way of locating myself in history. And also, the Bonnie Light Horseman Band, like, our first record is all reworkings of traditional texts. And then we've just created a record that is original songs, but they're meant to be in conversation with the old stuff. And it really, with that band especially, felt like it's just a spectrum, you know, and that it's a relief almost to realize that you're not coming up with this stuff from scratch. Like, we're all living in a world in which there's, you know, there's 11 notes in the scale and there's only so many stories. There's only so many words that you could tell those stories mm-hmm. with. And so we're standing on the backs, you know, of the stuff that came before. And that's I think, a really inspiring and relieving feeling that you don't have to hold up the universe.
You know, one of those Venn diagrams I love on your first album, you quote T.S. Eliot in The Room the Women Come and Go, speaking on their mobile phones. I'm not getting the rhyme exactly, but I love that. I love that sort of how you make that, the stuff that feels more ancient and permanent with this like contemporary reference.
Thank you. I would like not write that line today.
No, you wouldn't?
No, I wouldn't.
It would be sacrilege or?
I don't know. It just felt very literary. I've sort of maybe been running from academia since those days. I would have mm-hmm. been like an undergrad when I wrote that.
Pretty good for an undergrad.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Did your father approve? He's the professor in the family.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. So this is a great record. What's next?
So, we just put out this new Bonnie Light record.
Okay.
It's called Rolling Golden Holy. Just like last week it came out and we've been touring with it. This year has been a crazy amount of travel because I've been touring this record as well as the Bonnie Light record. And so I'm already like pretty psyched to go home and do some writing. I'm sort of desperate to do it. I feel like I've gotten some records out of my system, which I really needed to do. And now, you know, I would love, if the right story came along, like to work on something longer form, to do, I have a dream to write a play that actually doesn't have music in mm-hmm. it. We'll see what happens.
Do you have the story idea for it or?
I do, but I shouldn't say it on the mic.
You're not going to say it on the mic. That's great.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's been terrific.
My pleasure. Thank you
great
so much.
Great album. You want to do one more? You want to do the short one?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it.
What's it called?
It's called Real World.
All right.
Yeah. I want to live in the real world. Wake up to real birds singing loud enough to be really heard by us in the real world. I want to lie in the real grass. Watch the real clouds rolling past the pastures, the everlasting fields of the real world. I want to talk with my mouth full, pass around the vegetables with real folks at a real table, a meal in the real world. I want to dance in your real grip, feel your real hands on my hips, taste real whiskey on your lips when we kiss in the real world. I want to cry on your shoulder, real feelings flowing over, blow my nose while you really hold me close in the real world. I want to live in the real world, wake up to real birds singing loud enough to be really heard by us in the real world.
Thanks to Anais Mitchell for coming through to talk about Hadestown. You can hear a new album and a playlist of other songs at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, Jennifer Sanchez, our editor is Sophie Crane. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.